I'm very happy and so excited, and my heart is full of joy that I can welcome John Montgomery to the Conscious Evolution Summit today. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Paria. It's really nice to be here.
And I also want to send out a warm welcome to you listening to the audio and watching the video. And I really kind of, I'm so happy that you joined the summit from wherever you might be on this planet, because I assume we will reach people all over the planet with this common interest in bringing consciousness into our personal life, into all contexts of life, into relationship, into work life, into finances, into business, really everywhere. And so, yeah, John, we are right in the topic, because I know you are also very passionate about that. And as I assume with every person which is interested in bringing awareness and enlighten really all aspects of our life, we first of all need to have an deeper individual understanding of who and what we basically are in order to have this wish and this longing to bring this love and this connectivity we know we basically have in our reality really everywhere. And maybe kind of, John, we could maybe start a bit personal, where you maybe first share how you came to this path of inner growth and development and expanding it into the corporate world.
Well, I think my story really started when I was a fairly miserable attorney at a large corporate law firm in the middle of Silicon Valley. And lawyers who work for big international corporate firms are essentially high-paid indentured servants. We get paid very, very well, but the deal is we are on call 24/7, 365 days a year. And I was about, 9 years into my career, and I was very, very unhappy. And a friend of mine turned me on to a book by Thupten Chodron, Open Heart, Clear Mind, something like that. And there was a passage in the book: if somebody calls you an idiot, where's the harm? Is it in I? Is it in D? Is it in OT? You're the one that's creating the harm. And there was something in how that was phrased that totally rearranged my mind. It was like all of a sudden I could feel all the synapses in my brain just rearranging. And I realized, oh my God, I have a choice about how I respond to reality. And I have a choice about how I respond to every single aspect of reality. And I can choose to be a miserable associate attorney at a big law firm, or I can choose to be happy. The choice is up to me. And I decided in that moment to love the law. And I started going around my law firm saying, God, I love the law. And at first it seemed so disingenuous, because I really didn't love the law at the time. I'm a big picture person. To survive in the law, you have to manage details. You have to eat details for breakfast. And details were the bane of my existence. So I decided to just love the details. And I learned how to manage the details. I learned how to make a game out of getting good at managing the details. And I started to love my clients. I started to love my coworkers. And by just repeating this silly mantra, God, I love the law, you know, after a year or two, I actually started to believe it, and I started to actually love what I was doing. And because I started to love what I was doing, I got really good at what I was doing. And clients wanted to work for me, and my colleagues wanted to work for me and with me. And all of a sudden, I got very successful. So I made love my operating system. And I also got the string of the Tibetan Vajrayana path. That was in probably 1991 or 1992. And I just kept pulling on that string. And I ultimately got a Tibetan teacher. I went deep into the Tibetan mind training program. I did a Tibetan 3-year retreat over a distance learning program through Rigpa and Sogol Rinpoche, and took that path to the end. And basically, that's really how the journey began. And Sogol Rinpoche used to tell us, you know, be a hidden yogi. It's not the time to go sit in a cave somewhere. You gotta take this mind training. You gotta take this path and integrate it into your life and just be a normal Joe. And so that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to integrate my spiritual path with who I am in the world.
Yeah, and basically, I guess for all of us who are on this path for a longer time, then there comes a time where it's not separate anymore, where it's so intrinsically really moving in everything. So where you can't, separation basically is not possible anymore.
Right.
If you would kind of maybe act not really from what you deeply value or where you deeply resonate with, it feels harmful.
Well, it may be harmful, but it's not in alignment. And I think it doesn't really matter what spiritual path you take, but if you choose one and take it to the end, I think what invariably happens is you clear away all of the obscurations. You know, in the Buddhist path, we all have Buddha nature. In the Christian path, you know, we all have Christ consciousness. And the trick is to remember that that's who we are. And how do you get in touch with that? And that's really the path. And each one of us, you know, as the neuroscience is beginning to show, is essentially a radio transmitter and receiver. And when we get really in tune with our mind-body system, each one of us is unique. We have unique experience. We have unique DNA. We have unique cultural and social conditioning. And the signal that we receive from the universe is unique. And the expression of that signal through each of us is unique. And what's common to that signal is I believe the underlying frequency or operating system of the universe is love. And so we, you know, our job is to connect with that and be as true to who we are in our unique constellation of that whole, and be that in the world. That's our essential job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in your experience, John, because I know that you kind of really, you work with companies, with leaders in the corporate world, would you say that this deep knowing of that you kind of basically your essence is really made out of love, would you say it is necessary that a leader in a company realizes that first?
Well, it certainly helps. so, so As a startup company lawyer, I represented about 1,000 public and private companies in the course of my career. And I had a first row seat in how consciousness works in our collective life forms. We humans are tribal. We have complex social neurons in our brains. Every time we're in a group, those social neurons scan the group, determine who the leader is, deduce their values, their behavioral norms, and tune in to the field of consciousness that the leader is emanating. And the prevailing leadership style and methodology in the world is based on fear. It's power over and power under. And what I witnessed out of the 1,000 companies that I represented, there were about 12 where the leader had transcended fear and had stabilized his or her consciousness to the point where they were pretty consistently operating from the heart. And the field of consciousness that they emanated in those businesses was infectiously positive and harmonious. And many of your faculty in this program are students of flow. And what I witnessed in these corporations was the fostering of a collective flow state that's endemic of peak performance. When you have a leader that operates from the heart, they are animating that collective life form with the field of consciousness that they're emanating. And when that field of consciousness is love or unconditional love or joy or one of the higher states of consciousness, everybody tunes into that field, they show up fully. And the neuroscience shows that in those kinds of environments, we're twice as productive, we're twice as happy, the businesses have half the employee turnover. In other words, you know, you people stay, they like to work there. And most importantly, you have the high probability of accessing collective flow states that are endemic to peak human performance, of the type that you get in a band or a winning sports team or a choir. You can get that same phenomenon in a work group.
Mm-hmm. And John, how does it work? Do companies approach you and asking that you support them in this process, or how do you engage with your clients in the corporate world?
Well, you know, it's pretty well known in developmental circles that we have to meet people where we are. And it's our responsibility for those of us that are committed to self-actualization and personal development to remember where we came from and remember that all of us are at different stages of our path and at different stages of self-actualization. And that doesn't mean anybody's better or worse than anybody. It's like, you know, a second grader is not better or worse than a high school student. They're at the appropriate stage for themselves. And all of us are exactly where we're supposed to be. But those of us doing this work, we have to remember that we have to try to meet people where they are. So in my work, I work with corporate leaders all across the spectrum of development. So if you use an integral framework, I have teal leaders, I have green leaders, I have orange leaders, and I adopt my approach to meet people where they are. And some leaders are really ready to get into the nitty-gritty hidden dynamics of leadership, you know, how consciousness works individually and collectively, the neuroscience of leadership, the social neuroscience of leadership, all of that stuff. And I find that business people are generally well trained in left brain logic and often leading with the neuroscience, leading with the emergent science of consciousness, grounding it in logic makes people feel safe to begin to open up their heart and let go of fear. And that's really that's really the, you know, the biggest challenge is how do we get people to operate from the heart? Well, it really helps to have a spiritual path of some kind, because most of us are victimized by our amygdala and our limbic system. And, you know, we're walking fear detectors. We're walking danger detectors. And when our mind-body system sees something in our field that looks dangerous, we're gone. The amygdala kicks in, the frontal cortex goes offline, we're no longer present, automatic defense routines kick in, the blood goes from here into our legs and low back, and we're in fight or flight mode. And we're not even aware of it. So having a spiritual practice, a meditative practice, a martial arts practice, something that brings consciousness into that process so that you can return to center. You know, that's the basic building block of all of this. And then, you know, how do you get a leader from the frontal cortex to the heart? That's the next challenge, because in our super complex world, the frontal cortex, where logic resides, is too slow. We can process 3 to 7 things consciously in the frontal cortex, whereas our mind-body system, which is centered in the heart, and the electromagnetic field of the heart, as the folks from HeartMath will tell you, that system is processing 20 million bits of data every second. Yeah. And if you can get the center of your consciousness from the frontal cortex into your heart, you're in the middle of your mind-body system's Cray supercomputer, which is constantly crunching those 20 million bits of data with many multivariable calculus equations to come up with the optimal response for you for your ever-evolving present moment. And that's really the work. And so I try to meet, you know, some leaders are still victimized by the amygdala. Some leaders have figured out how to stabilize their consciousness here. Some leaders are already operating from the heart, and they just need a little bit of encouragement to let it rip. And put love into how they lead. Mm-hmm. So it really depends.
And when I listen to you, John, so what comes up for me is, yes, I can kind of really follow that a person can make this transition, kind of really bringing awareness from there to the heart. But then what came to my mind, but then we have outer structures there, kind of how companies are set up, how laws are, you know, rules and structures outside there where maybe they have a different frequency than maybe the leader who is in this heart, and how can we kind of play with that and bring that into alignment?
Well, you're doing a wonderful job of that with this conference, because you're bringing in a lot of people who are creating a collective field that is running at the frequency of love rather than fear. I'm grossly simplifying things, but you can, one model of consciousness is we humans have essentially two speeds. We're either fear-based or we're love-based. And the global economic matrix, the global economic system itself runs on fear primarily. And all of the systems make it very difficult to transcend that hidden operating system. You know, fear and greed run the economy. And what does a love-based economy look like? What does love-based leadership look like? You know, Frederick Laloux, in his Reinventing Organizations, profiles 12 companies that have leaders that essentially lead from the heart. And he describes this new paradigm of leadership where the leader is operating from the heart, sensing and responding to reality. And when we get enough of us, we are essentially co-creating an alternative matrix that runs on love rather than fear. And that's really what's coming. So we're changing leadership, and we're changing the structures that keep us stuck in a fear-based paradigm. So in the corporation, for example, a lot of my work has been about changing the DNA and the sponsoring thought of the corporation. Now, the corporation is a European colonial construct that was invented by the kings of Europe as an agent of empire. It's a 500-year-old form. It conquers foreign markets and exploits them for the royal treasury really well. And that's what corporations are designed to do. Conquer markets and exploit the hell out of them without regard to the people or environment there. So the basic design of the corporation is it's engineered to default to sociopathic behavior, because the corporation exists for one purpose: to maximize shareholder welfare. And it's morally acceptable to foist the negative consequences of corporate behavior onto society and the environment. So we directors live by the golden rule, but we get in the boardroom and the rule of gold applies. And we get a hall pass from morality. So the conscience mechanism of the collective life form of the corporation is very primitive, because you only have to take care of the shareholders. You get a hall pass from taking care of your employees, the environment, the community in which you do business, your customers. It's all about maximizing profit for the owners. So there's a group of us around the world that are working in complementary disciplines to redesign the legal system, to redesign how corporations are made, to redesign the accounting system so that it goes from mono-capitalism to multiple capitalism. You measure natural capital, relationship capital, intellectual capital, and start to account for the negative consequences of corporate behavior. So you're absolutely right. You can have a heart-based leader, and that leader can lead the business from the heart, but the larger that business becomes and the more entrenched it becomes in the public markets, the harder it is to operate from the heart, because the matrix basically requires it to maximize stockholder welfare at the expense of society and the environment. And that's really the essence of my work. I bring leaders into the heart, and I work on redesigning the governance architecture of corporations so that they're prone to altruistic behavior. So you marry a new corporate form like the benefit corporation with heart-based leadership, and suddenly you have the potential to create much more enlightened collective life forms. And since we have 80,000 multinational corporations, these are the largest and most powerful life forms on the planet. And they have relatively primitive consciousness. If you mapped their consciousness on any developmental scale, it's pretty low in development. So if we can bring the wisdom from our wisdom and spiritual traditions into leadership and translate it into language that leaders can understand and follow, and we change the sponsoring thoughts of the global economic system, we could change things very, very quickly.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, maybe I it's really not at all my topic where I'm really in, but to imagine how long it takes to change laws.
Well, here's the good news. Here's the exciting thing. Corporate law, well, lawyers in general, we are fear-based, we're risk-averse, we swear oaths to uphold the status quo. And we're very conservative, in other words. Corporate law in the United States never changes. You know, the last significant innovation in corporate law before the Benefit Corporation came in, I think, 1811, when New York invented free incorporation and limited liability, put those two concepts together. And limited liability corporations that can be freely incorporated populate the global economic system. That's the global standard. And, you know, the Benefit Corporation is the first significant innovation to come along in a while because it changes the doctrine of shareholder primacy, because all of a sudden the corporation exists not for the sole purpose of maximizing stockholder welfare, but for a heroic purpose of providing a material positive impact on society and the environment. So it changes the game. And the first Benefit Corporation law was passed in the United States in 2010. It's now in 35 states, the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. It's in Italy. It's in Colombia. There are 12 countries that are considering adopting Benefit Corporation legislation equivalent. So in the field of law, that is rapid. And what excites me is, as somebody who came from Silicon Valley, I watched wave after wave of disruptive technology come through, from email to personal computers to the browser. And within 3, 4, 5, 6 years, these innovations would go global. They go viral. And these innovations are disruptive technologies. And what's really, really exciting is that once those who run those 80,000 multinationals figure out that operating from the heart in businesses that are actually designed with a multiple stakeholder model are better businesses. They provide better long-term value for shareholders. And they provide, by providing for all of the business's stakeholders, they have greater loyalty, they spend less on advertising, they're much more sustainable and profitable companies. So love as an operating system runs circles around fear, and businesses that are designed with the notion that we're one common family sharing one common planetary home, and it's our obligation as individuals and business leaders to take care of our precious planet and our collective human family. And the doctrine of shareholder primacy, which is an extractive one where you extract value out of the system and try to externalize your costs onto that system, that's going to be a dinosaur. Mm-hmm. Because there is no over there anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. And John, in your perspective, in the whole picture, what role has the consumer? How is everyone kind of able to contribute to a change in how businesses are run when I'm not a leader in a company? How is that influence happening?
Well, it's really exciting that you asked that question, because I'm in New Orleans, where the B Corp community had its, I think, 9th annual Champions Retreat. So it was a gathering of Benefit Corporations and B Corps from North America. There's a similar gathering in Europe. It just happened in Amsterdam. There's a similar one in Latin America. It'll be in Patagonia in November. And one of the things that we are initiating is a vote every day campaign. And basically, with technology, we all live in a glass house. So we as consumers have the power of our checkbook, our pocketbook, and we can vote with our purchases. We can support businesses that make organic food. We can support businesses that pay their employees a living wage. We can support businesses that don't pollute, that sequester carbon, that engage in good business practices, that hold themselves accountable to the collective. So we, the consumer, can vote with our pocketbook and make very powerful choices to support businesses that have made a commitment to being sustainable. And that's the exciting thing about the new corporate forms. There's a lot of greenwashing. There's a lot of grandstanding, marketing. But when you adopt one of these new corporate forms, you're making a legal commitment. In the United States, it's to provide a material positive impact on society and the environment from your operations taken as a whole. So you're legally committing your enterprise to do the right thing by society and the environment, in addition to your shareholders. And you're making a commitment to hold yourself accountable by measuring how well you're doing that against a third-party standard. And there's also a measure of transparency where you commit to reporting how you're doing to the public and your shareholders every year.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot more power to create our world with our actions than we realize.
Yeah. I'm happy that we really mentioned that as well. And John, I would like to ask you, in which way, where is it really your passion to kind of bring this consciousness into this collective forms? So in which way you really love to contribute to that?
Well, that's a really, really good question, Maria. You know, I was a corporate lawyer I've been a corporate lawyer for 34 years, and I loved helping entrepreneurs design and create their businesses. It was a fabulous process, very creative. Every startup company was a short story, a comedy, a tragedy, a novella, a play. Different characters, different technologies. The plot was basically the same, but it was fascinating. And what I've evolved to is what really turns me on is when I get to work with a leader, a business leader who is really ready to cultivate his or her executive presence. That's usually how it's couched. You know, I do a lot of executive coaching. And my clients are usually big public companies, and they send an executive to me, and basically the mandate is, we want this person to develop an executive presence, and we have no idea how to do that, but they're ready. That's their next step in their evolution, and we need you to help. We know what it looks like, but we don't know how to go about it. Can you help with that? And usually, I find about somewhere between a third and a half of my executive coaching clients are ready for me to translate the architecture of consciousness that I've distilled from various shamanic traditions I've studied, from the Christian tradition, from the Catholic tradition, from the Buddhist tradition, and from all of the emerging neuroscience, and give them essentially a modern version of pointing out mind instructions so that they suddenly understand that this magnificent mind-body system that our consciousness is embedded in is the complete package. And how we take care of that mind-body system, how we hold that system, how we take care of our emotional body, our spiritual body, our physical body, our mental body, how we have to work to get all of that into alignment, how we show up, everything we do as a leader matters. And how do we optimize our ability to emanate the optimal frequency of consciousness that we're able of emanating. Mm-hmm. And if you really want to cultivate executive presence, it comes from the heart. You have to be able to create a brave and safe container where people who have chosen you as their leader feel safe and empowered to show up fully as who they are. Mm-hmm. And you generally can't do that unless you and other leaders are operating from the heart.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, John, I had it in a conversation in another interview. So we kind of, what we discovered there, that in a way, when you would be really in your leadership power, you want to be all other people's also embodying their full potential and thriving and bringing it. So kind of, would then be the next step, do you then also work with, let's say, the whole company, or are you more focused just on the leader of the company? And how does it translate into the whole big system of a company?
Well, I'm still in the beginning of my second career. I tell people I'm following the breadcrumbs. I'm following where the energy is and what excites me. So this interview, it really turned me on. It was like, okay, I'm supposed to be in this interview with Pariah. I'm noticing that it gives me a high amount of energy. I get that same charge when I work with an executive who's really ready, who often I am is a mirror. I hold the mirror up and I point out to the person how magnificent they are. And encourage them to be brave and express their full magnificence. And so the other thing that happens is, all of us, we are transmitting, an imprint. Our mind-body system is energetically transmitting an imprint. And hopefully, if we've done our work, we're providing an imprint of what a relatively healthy, balanced mind-body system is. And so part of the work, I spend a lot of time making sure that I'm as tuned up as possible. Mm-hmm. So when I show up for my coaching clients and I show up for my work, I am as impeccable as I possibly can be. I am present for them, and I am being as good a role model as I possibly can to reflect what they are. That's what my mind and body system does. It's part of the hidden dynamic of leadership. Mm-hmm. So, some leaders are ready for the conversation about, how the chakra system is actually transmitting information, that most of what we communicate verbally, that's a very small fraction of what's actually happening. And on some level, it really doesn't matter what my words are, because most of what I'm communicating is in the auric field, in the energy, and so on and so forth. But I have to be very careful in the corporate world to really meet people where they are, mm-hmm. and keep things grounded in the emerging science, and not get too woo-woo, not to get too far out there.
Yeah.
And because the matrix doesn't want people to escape. It's a fear-based system, power over, power under, and it doesn't want people to escape and change the paradigm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but in a way, what is really beautiful, because with your, let's say, as you said, now you are in your second career. So your first career, you really, you know this world, you know this matrix. So you are really able to move in it and to support change really from inside out. And that for me makes so much sense. And I hope and I wish that many people find the courage and the energy and the support to not escape from workplaces, from companies, from different contexts or from relationships, but really try to transform and change something from inside out, because that's the work we need to do.
We need to do. Well, and we do this, it's a microcosm of what we have to do internally, right? Yeah. And what I try to do is, you know, every single person almost that I've run into in my corporate career, you know, I've worked with thousands of executives. By and large, they're really, really good people. Mm-hmm. They love their children. They love their spouses. They love their community. They love their hobbies. You know, there are a lot of things that they love. They follow the golden rule. They go to church. They go to synagogue. They go to temple. They have spiritual teachers. They're really good people, but there's something about business. Oh, it's just business. And we all know how to be good, loving human beings. A lot of my work is just reminding people that, you know, you don't have to have a bifurcated life. You can be the same loving person you are with your daughters, with all of your employees, because, you know, ultimately, you know, we're one human family, and those employees are just as much your children on a cosmic level as your own children. Mm-hmm. And why would you treat them with any less love and respect than you treat your own children? And so a lot of the work is just empowering people to have the courage to be who they are in most of their lives in the business world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe really just, I also would like to invite and encourage a lot of people really just living that by example, because I'm really convinced that the more we see it, the more we find this resonance in us and we don't feel alone with it. And we see so many people are really longing to live their deep, deep values in all contexts. So, yeah, so I hope that we remind each other, we encourage each other, we support that this really becomes our fundamental way of operating in every system and structure we are. Yeah.
Well, and for a lot of your audience that I'm sure is following some sort of a spiritual or personal development path, the intersection between the individual path and the collective is really exciting, because everything we do influences the consciousness that is flowing in every collective that we're a part of. And think of all the groups that each one of us is a part of. We're a couple. We're a family. We're an extended family. We're a sports team. We're a choir. We're a business group. We're a board of directors. And if you think about each one of those groupings as a tribe that is triggering our social neurons to create an invisible group, if you understand that the basic rule of tribes is that he or she with the most love-based field of consciousness is generally the natural leader of that group. And so, you know, be aware that somebody may be de jure the leader. They may be the president, but if they're running on fear and you're operating from the heart, guess what? De facto, you're the leader. Mm-hmm. And everybody is going to look to you, and you have tremendous ability to set the field of consciousness in that collective. Mm-hmm. So all the work that everybody is doing on their individual spiritual paths, and this is the other part of my key takeaway, is that all of our spiritual traditions focus on our individual salvation or enlightenment. But we're tribal. We live in groups. We're predated creatures. We don't have claws. We don't have fangs. And to survive from an evolutionary biology perspective, we learned how to create tribal units with our social neuronal structure. So we're constantly, whether we're aware of it or not, creating these invisible neural networks that are basically, from an evolutionary biology standpoint, how we have survived as a species. Hmm. And a lot of my work is just making this basic architecture obvious, an object, as they say in the integral community, so that people, we all know this intuitively. We've all felt this. But to make it object for people, one of the most fun things in my work is when I see the mm-hmm. dots get connected and the light bulbs go off and people go, oh, that's why Joan is the leader in our group. She's setting the field. She's operating from the heart. She loves everybody. And everybody and her department works really well, and nobody, she has no turnover, and everybody's happy. Oh, got it. That's what's happening over there. Wow.
Yeah.
So we have so much more power to create our reality than we realize. Mm-hmm. And just understanding, you know, that's part of the joy of my work is a lot of natural leaders intuitively understand all this hidden neuroscience and the evolutionary biology of leadership and the science of consciousness of collectives and so on and so forth. But when you name it for them, when you hold it up and say, are you aware that, you know, I think intuitively you've got this figured out, but there's this whole other world going on. You know, the frontal cortex is about 1% of our mind-body system's intelligence. And there's this whole genius, social genius that we're a part of that most of us are oblivious to. So just making this object is very powerful because our state of being really matters. If we're operating with love, it has enormous ripple effects, mm-hmm. positive ripple effects everywhere we go. Mm-hmm. And if we're operating from fear, from the amygdala, it tends to contract everything. So,
and what makes me really curious, because on a personal level or working one-on-one with clients, what I really can see is that the more we are able to access as awareness into our depth, into our being, into invisible realms, the more we seem to have abilities available, which we intellectually, we don't know where they come from and how it happens, but there is a notion of almost magic then there, where you get information, intuitions, insights, synchronicity, attracting things. And that, I mean, when kind of imagining that would happen on a large scale, that just excites me. I want to kind of be able to experience it. I don't know how this then kind of, what consequences this would have, what this would really look like, but I feel an excitement when I tune into that possibility.
Well, and look what you've done with this conference. You went into the field of infinite possibilities. You went into the quantum field. You got a download, and you weren't afraid of the information that you received, and you said, okay, I guess I'm going to create this conference. I'm going to invite people. I'm going to do it. And that's part of the magic. You know, my job as a startup company lawyer, I lived in the field of infinite possibilities because entrepreneurs would come to me and they'd say, you know, I want to quit my job at Cisco and I want to start this company and my wife thinks I'm nuts and we're going to need $5 million. And, you know, what do you think? And I'd say, hey, no problem. I know people that will fund it and let's get you organized. And yeah. And you know, I was the midwife. I can go into the field of infinite possibilities with them and pull the possibility out and manifest it. And all of us have that ability.
Yes, and really what is really exciting that when we really surrender to that, when we give all our talents, our love, our passion to that, much more is possible than we would think is possible. When you surrender to that, so much comes and joins you and supports you. So I couldn't have imagined before what all is coming. And still, I mean, it's not just an easy, fun walk, as I had also in conversation with Justin Fairman and Jackie Knechtel, which have this institute for flow consciousness. They also say it's still difficult, it's still work, you still have challenges, but you also gather or kind of get the resources. You build up a capacity, what is needed in order to follow this impulse. And I can just say, yes, that's like it. And I hope, I just want to inspire people also, if they feel this impulse and it's such a powerful stream, then kind of I sense it as an almost an electric current or a big water stream which carries you, that we dare to follow, and that we maybe kind of also ask in our surrounding for support, but it would be such a pity not surrendering to it, because I sense much more is possible when we do that.
Well, and when your viewers see the video of you in this conversation, they're going to feel the field, because you have I can feel it. You know, I get goosebumps when I get most connected to the field of infinite possibilities, the quantum field, however you want to call it. And the, you know, there's a phenomenon in the Eastern traditions called the cities, where, you know, when a person has stabilized their consciousness, or the seat of consciousness has dropped from the head to the heart, and you've stabilized your consciousness at love or unconditional love. Actually, the research shows that it's unconditional love or above. The cities start showing up, and you get these. They're almost like superpowers that come in, and you have absolutely no control over them. And spiritual teachers get into trouble when they claim that they own these superpowers, because my experience with them and conversations with others that have experienced some of these phenomenon, they just come, and they come unexpectedly. It's part of the flow, and it's almost like you're in a crisis situation, and all of a sudden the universe hands you a Swiss Army knife. It just appears from the ether, and you have exactly the superpower that's needed for the present circumstance. And then it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we humans, I think, are just scratching the surface,
yes,
of our enormous potential.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we tune ourselves in to be able to connect to the quantum field, to our Buddha nature, you know, to our Christ consciousness, anything is possible.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I, as you're showing with this conference, right? It's just, I think I'm going to create an international conference and get some very interesting people, and we're going to create a collective field and invite everybody to the party.
And the funny thing is, you know, I have now so much to do with technique, and I have a smartphone since less than 1 year. So I'm not a technique person at all. But I said, I don't mind. I do everything what is needed, because I sense kind of life chose me to do that. So I bring all what I can. I bring also my not knowing and try what I need to learn. And I sold a life insurance so that I have financial resources to do it, because it just was my next thing what I do without knowing kind of what it leads me to. I don't know, but it's really exciting. I love it. I sense that everything of me is used for manifesting it, and I'm so happy. I mean, you know, John, having people like you in this conversation, and really I so much sense that when we share this passion, when we share this love, and when many people share it, and tuning in this field, I'm so sure that we will make a difference, and we contribute into a direction where we really long to creating a world like that. So, yeah.
Well, it's Maggie and I joke about, ultimately it's presence healing, right? It's in the Eastern traditions, you know, it's Shakti pot, the mind to mind transmission. It's being in the auric field of the master. Ultimately it's the field. When we do the work and we tune in, and we find our own connection to source, however we define that, whatever our spiritual tradition is, and we connect with that, and we operate from that, and we become that in the world, and we become an ambassador to that. And that's really our job. And it's not necessarily what workshop we're putting on, or what technique we've come up with, or what book we've done, or what webinar, or whatever we're trying to do down here to make a living. It's just being love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we humans need. That's all we need. When we are loved, we can do anything. Anything's possible. And I think that's, you know, in the Christian tradition, you know, there's talk about the second coming. And my sense is the second coming is not some beautiful woman with flowing hair, or some guy with long hair and a beard who's, you know, the enlightened one or whatever. It's the collective field. It's when enough of us decide, you know what? You know, he who loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. It's about being love. And that's, you know, that's really the, if humanity can operate from that point, and if enough of us decide that that's where we're going to operate from.
Yeah. And as you said in the beginning, and I really love that we kind of coming back to that now at the end of our conversation, it has such a unique expression through everyone, in because we have that, we bring so unique forms, and of course the essence, the love, is the same substance, but it has and such unique expression through everyone. So I really I'm happy that we kind of really come back to it and encourage that when we surrender to that, allow also this unique expression coming through us. Yeah. Wonderful. John, I mean, I know that we both love this conversation. And I hope others can also feel that joy we had together moving in this flow. And is there anything left where you want to use this time and this field we are kind of connected with the summit, a message you want to give out?
Well, one thing that, you know, I'm heading from New Orleans to Washington, D.C., where I'm on a panel at the National Association of Corporate Directors annual Directors Summit on Monday on the future of capitalism. And what the download that came in as we were talking is the average director of global multinational corporations is a 62-year-old white male who looks pretty much like me. I'm 61, so I'm a little bit younger than the average, but I'm basically the corporate archetype of a member of the board of directors that controls these 80,000 multinationals that basically run our economy. And what came in is most of these directors are grandmothers and grandfathers. And I was just with a grandfather last night. He has 7 grandchildren, and he flew back from New Orleans to Philadelphia to be with his grandchildren today. And if the corporate, so the download I got was, if all of the directors of these corporations brought the same love that they have for their children and grandchildren into the boardroom and extended that to all of their businesses' stakeholders, we would change the world very, very quickly. And it would be a completely different place.
Hmm.
So that's the vision that came in. Yeah. So if you could just hold that vision for me for 11:30 Monday morning, as I'm on the panel, we're gonna funnel this field that you and I have connected to into that room on Monday, so that whoever shows up can really connect with the love that's in their hearts.
Mm-hmm. And I would even kind of, what I get now when I listen to you, extend this kind of, because you spoke from the grandparents, grandfather with their grandchildren, but for everyone, some other form could be something which we connect with the deep love we have towards this. And if we could kind of be in relationship, do what we do always with this attitude, we are doing it towards and for something we love, can be really some physical form, can be something abstract, that would make a huge change.
So that's what I'm hoping for, is to have enough of us to connect to the leaders around the world, to just inspire them to do what they already know how to do, to lead from the heart.
Mm. And what I also get when we all kind of would be able to not judge them in not doing so, but really connecting to the future potential where everyone would uncover that, you know, if you really would hold it in the collective, that we have enough trust and we have enough faith that every leader is able to connect to that. If we hold that as a potential in the field, I feel that also very powerful.
I can feel it, you know, we're all working for everybody's grandchildren.
Yes. Lovely. What a lovely sentence to close our conversation. And I hope that was not the last one, to be honest.
Well, we will circle back.
I thank you so much that you made space in your schedule. I know you are traveling. You have a few events. So I'm very happy that you made that possible. And I really, I wish you all the best in what you do, John.
Thank you, Pariah. And send my love to all of my friends on your faculty. It's a wonderful group to be a part of, and I love so many of them already. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for you watching and listening our conversation. I hope you could also sense the field, the collective field of love, of infinite possibility, of really tapping into our full potential. I felt it very vivid in this conversation, and I hope you also could sense it. I thank you so much, and all the best also to you.
Thank you, Pariah.